It's time for us to begin. Open your Bible to Matthew 24 and 25. We're going to be primarily in those two chapters in our study tonight, 24 and 25. All right. In our study last week, we spent a considerable amount of time examining some thoughts from Matthew 24 to come to the conclusion that a good portion of Matthew 24, if not the greater portion of it, involves the fall of the city of Jerusalem. We noted that at the conclusion of that, the text begins in verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you know not on what day your Lord cometh. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what watch the thief was coming, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken through. Therefore be ye ready, also ready, for in an hour that ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." Now that becomes an introduction to the next three parables that I want to talk with you about in our study tonight. We notice that in these three parables, it is illustrating the need to be prepared at all times. And I think that the thought that we want to emphasize here is these folks didn't know when the Roman soldiers would descend upon the city of Jerusalem. They didn't know exactly when that would be. There would be some signs that would predicate that. But concerning the final judgment, if you please, there are not any signs that predicate that. Not any signs that would forecast the coming of Jesus in the second coming or the final judgment. But whether we're talking about the fall of Jerusalem or the second coming of the Lord, the need to be prepared is the thing that is stressed in these verses. And that's what we want to note. We've noted already in verse 36, and I've somewhat changed my view of verse 36, acknowledging that Matthew 24 has some complexities and perhaps it's not as simple as I had originally explained it to be. But we do know that the things that the disciples are concerned about, when one stone would not be left upon another, were very disconcerting to them. And they wanted to know, when shall these things be? I'm confident that they associated the end of Judaism with the end of everything. That was their life. And so that thought is addressed in the answer that Jesus gives. However, we noted in verse 34, he said that these things shall come upon this generation. He said, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. Heaven and earth, verse 35, shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no one, not even the angels of heaven, neither the Son, but the Father only. And then he begins to describe the urgency of their need to be prepared. Now, what has made me somewhat change my thinking a little bit on the simplicity of this passage and what's called the transition text of verse 36, which I can make the arguments for that if you would like, but I don't believe that I can do so any more consistently because of verse 38 in this text. It says in verse 38, "For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and ye not when the flood would come." And then in verse 40, it says, "Then shall two men be in the field, and one is taken and one is left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, one is taken and one is left." Now we compared Mark's account and Luke's account, and the chronology, that's the point of emphasis, the chronology of Mark's account and Luke's account, to note that that's parallel to this text. And the chronology of the one being in the field and the two women grinding at the mill, that illustration is used in reference to the time prior to the fall of Jerusalem. So our lesson tonight focuses our attention upon the need to be prepared, because we don't know when the coming of the Lord is going to be, whether it was the destruction of Jerusalem in this case or whether it be the final judgment in our case. We don't know when that's coming. And we do know the certainty, and the certainty of both was stated in this text, as we shall see as we progress from the 24th chapter on into the 25th chapter. Now, I said that by way of introduction, there are three parables. There is the parable of the faithful and the unfaithful servants that we're going to pick up on in verse 45 and talk about. And then there is the parable of the 10 virgins, 5 who were wise and 5 who were foolish, in the first few verses of the 25th chapter. And then there is the parable of the talents in the 25th chapter, beginning about verse 14. And Jenny, I've got an assignment for you. I know that you're quite capable. You may already know this. I'm trying to remember in today's amounts about how much a talent would be. If that was a day's wage or a year's wage, you figure that out. I've known that. I may have it written in my notes. I think that a talent is the equivalent, according to my notes, of 300 shekels. And this is where I get mixed up. 3,000 shekels. And one shekel becomes then the equivalent of one day's wage. So then one talent, in the parable of the talents, we'll talk about this when we get to it, would be the equivalent of about 3,000 days' wages. And if you could verify that for me, that would be helpful. So just that's your assignment. Now, that don't mean don't listen to the rest of the class, but you go ahead and work on that for me. Okay? The parable of the faithful and the unfaithful servants. Let's begin reading at verse 45. Again, noting the context. He's just talked with them about the need for preparedness. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his Lord has set over his household to give them their food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you that he will set him over all that he hath. But if that servant, that evil servant, shall say in his heart, My Lord tarrieth, and shall begin to beat his fellow servants, and shall eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he expecteth not, and in an hour when he knoweth not, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint his portion with the hypocrites, and there shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Now, the lesson in this is not very difficult, I don't believe. We see the analogy. We've got a wise and we've got a foolish, evil servant. The wise servant fulfills his responsibility. His responsibility is set food before the household, and to do that at the appropriate time. And that servant is described as blessed when his Lord comes and finds him doing his job. But the evil servant, we're going to see an analogy a little bit later regarding slothfulness. This evil servant said, My Lord tarried and shall begin to beat his fellow servants and shall eat and drink with the drunken. You see the kind of lifestyle that he has assumed, and the role over the other servants that he has presumed. And you'll notice that the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he expecteth not, and in an hour when he knoweth not, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. I could just stop there and say, enough said. We've read the parable, and it's not difficult to understand. The reward to the man who is righteous is seen. His Lord's pleased with him, and he's given a position over all that he has. The evil servant presumes a role that his Lord didn't give him, and he began to beat the other servant. But notice his reasoning. He said, My Lord tarrieth. Now that's going to be repeated in the next two. So in all three of these parables, we find that to be the common thread. The reasoning on behalf of those who were foolish. My Lord tarries. Now, what do we often do? I'm going to talk to all of us because we've all been there, and especially perhaps during your college days. Any of you know when the class began what was expected of you in that class. The teacher passes out this syllabus, and in the syllabus, the way it used to be done, maybe your classes didn't do that, they passed out a syllabus the first day of class. And so you know what's going to be expected of you in that class. If you want to pass the class, you want to succeed with an A in the class, this is what you're expected to do. It might involve a number of things, like memorizing so many passages, as the case was in my particular case, writing a research paper, or reading so much material and writing research papers on that material. Any of you all ever been there? Had that experience at least once? Now, on the first day of the class, you read the syllabus and the teacher's giving instruction, and you know exactly what's going to be required of you by the end of the semester. So you went to work on that right away, didn't you? Every one of you in the class. The very next day, you went to working on the material that was in that syllabus, right?
Jenny did.
Jenny did. She did. Oh. Well, most of us, I would dare say, on the first day of the real class, that is, the next day after he passes out the syllabus and talks with you about the class, I dare say most of us did not begin working on the material that very day. And we likely reasoned, well, you know, I've got a whole semester. This is not due until the end of the semester. And so I'll give it a little time. I mean, this first day of class. So I don't have to be concerned about that now. Now, the thing is, you know when the semester is going to end. And you know the date on the calendar when all of this work is due, don't you? You know that. You know that the day the class starts. But for some reason, we reason like this man did, "My Lord tarrieth." I've got plenty of time. I can prepare next week, next month. I can do this and this and this today and tomorrow, and then I'll begin to work on this material. Now, is there anybody that can stick their hand way up in the air and say, "I never even thought such a thing"? I don't see any hands. Which tells me that we've all had the thought just like this man had. I've got plenty of time. Now, the thought that the Lord is trying to inject into this discussion is, you don't know that. You don't know when the Lord is coming. And you don't know when the judgment will be. Now, that's the parable of the faithful and the unfaithful servant. Now, what I want to call your attention to very pointedly is in verse 51. Look carefully at verse 51. It says, "And shall cut him asunder and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth." Now, this wicked servant, this evil man, that presumed some things that he could do because his Lord tarried, Jesus not only called him wicked, but he said, here's what's going to happen to him. He's going to be cut asunder, and his portion will be appointed with the hypocrites. And what's there? The weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Now, I want to suggest to you that that's not describing the fall of the city of Jerusalem. The expression, the weeping and the gnashing of teeth, is used a number of times in the Scripture, and to my knowledge, every time it's used to talk about eternal judgment, eternal damnation. Now, whatever we might think about Matthew 24 and its relativeness to the study of the second coming of the Lord, it's right here in the parables that Jesus uses to illustrate the point. Number one, you don't know when Jerusalem's going to fall, but brethren, we know Jerusalem has already fallen. So what's the lesson that we want from this passage? We want to know that we don't know when the Lord is coming. And we know that when He does come, if we're found unfaithful, our portion will be in that place where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. That place that is appointed for the hypocrites. And where is that? That's hell. Now that brings it home to us. We don't have to wonder anymore what the context is about, do we? Well, let's look at the next parable. The next parable in Matthew 25. Now, I debated about whether or not to discuss some valuable lessons from these parables, but I don't think that I want to do that. I think I want us to see it as Jesus presented it here and not use this just as a text to preach a sermon. I want us to see the lessons that is in this context. In verse 1 of chapter 25, Then shall the kingdom of heaven be like unto 10 virgins. Now, one of the things that I've asked you to do in numerous studies we've had in times gone by is to place things on the timeline. And when you find expressions like therefore, so then, and wherefore, we see that a conclusion is being drawn from things that are given previous. And we've looked at expressions like tomorrow, this happened or such. And so we put these events on a timeline with some sequence. Now, in this passage, you'll note, he says in the first part of verse 1 of chapter 25, then shall the kingdom of heaven be like, and now we begin another parable. When is the then?
Go along with weeping and gnashing.
It does. So now we know that following on the context of the previous context, that he's talking about his second coming and the final judgment of all things. Okay? The need to be prepared. Now, you don't know when the coming of Jerusalem's fall is going to be. The text tells these people that, but we know it's already fallen. They didn't know it was coming. There wasn't going to be any particular signs that would precede that except the ones that Jesus told them. When you see the Roman armies around the city, you know to flee to the mountains. Now, regarding our preparedness, are we going to see a Roman army circle the city? No, we're not going to see that, are we? We're not going to see that. The suddenness of the Lord's second coming would be like the days of Noah. People eating and drinking and doing all these things that are common to everyday life. And the Lord came in an hour when you knew it not. All right? So the need to be prepared. So then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins who took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For the foolish, when they took their lamps, took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. Now, while the bridegroom tarried, see, here's the thing that we saw in the previous parable. They all slumbered and slept. Now, just again, I'm not going to preach a lesson from this, but make some observations along the way. We know that while the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. Now, they couldn't put on the television an episode of Andy Griffith, you see, and sit and wait and use up the time. So what did they do? Well, what do you do when sometimes you're waiting for something to happen? Do you not nap or fall asleep? And so they all slumbered and slept. Those who were wise and those who were foolish, they all slumbered and slept. And then the text tells us, but at midnight there is a cry, behold, the bridegroom, come ye forth to meet him. Now we need to identify who these virgins are. You do not read in this context of the bride. You don't read in this context of the bride. You read of the bridegroom. And you read of these 10 virgins, 5 who were wise and 5 who were foolish, who were expected to do something when the bridegroom came. Now, who would that indicate to you that these 10 virgins might be? Well, they're not the bride. Who are they? Well, not men, because they're, well, I've always taken this passage to indicate they were women. I don't know. I don't know that it necessitates that. But what we do know is they were those who were in the position to assist in the wedding with some honorable position. Now, one of the things that I found in my studies of the culture of the time over the years, the culture of the time is helpful to understanding this particular parable. Contrary to the way that we do things, we call up a preacher and we set the date on the calendar when the wedding is going to be, and then we work toward that, and we have this big wedding party of people, and we all assemble at the same place at the same time, and then we have a ceremony, and after the ceremony, the preacher or the justice of the peace or whoever the official is pronounces them husband and wife. Now, that's our culture, and it's quite different in this culture. In this culture, there was feasting that sometimes took a week to get through it all. And a lot of the feasting was done in the home of the, if memory serves me, the bride groom's family. And so when it came time for the marriage to take place as such, we're not talking about a formal service that would take 20 or 30 minutes or so to engage in, but this thing would end with somewhat of a march of all the parties involved to the new residence of the groom. And the bride's father then would, much like we do in this respect, say, "Who giveth this woman in marriage?" He would give the woman to the man, and they would go into their lodging place, and they were married. So the festivities would end with that kind of a cultural march to the place where the groom is now going to live. So this pronouncement, here comes the bridegroom. Oh man, we got things ongoing right now. The march is going. We've got to go. Now the point is, they didn't know when he was coming. But now he appears. And the text tells us in the latter part, or in verse 7, "Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps." Now some of you may have some experience with that. I don't know. When we were growing up on the farm, believe it or not, I'm not so old, but what we had electricity on the farm. But I do remember that the electricity was not always dependable. And we had a coal oil lamp. And we always grabbed the coal oil lamp when the electricity went off at night so we could be able to see. And I remember many nights where we would sit up with the coal oil lamp until it was bedtime. Then we'd shut the coal oil lamp off and go to bed. And I remember there were times when you would trim the wick in the coal oil lamp. Now that doesn't always mean taking scissors or a knife and cutting it off to where it's brand new, but where it's burned down, you want to clean that. Get the carbon off of it so that you've got room for the wick to draw up the coal oil up to the place where the flame is. Otherwise, you've got the carbon would separate between the wick and the flame, and you wouldn't have a nice burning light. And so that tells you how old I am. But the point is, that's what they're doing. That's just exactly what they're doing. Now, I don't know. The text doesn't describe. You had a lamp from Egypt, I believe you said, that was used for illustrative purposes to help us to know what kind of lamps they had. We're not told in this text exactly what kind of lamp it was. Well, that's beside the point. The point is, some had made preparation and some had not. Now, I want to call your attention to what time it was. It tells us that they all slumbered and slept, but verse 6, "But at midnight there is a cry." Now, that's important to us in the following context. There's a cry, "Come ye forth to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, "Give us of your oil, for our lamps are going out." Now, I don't know how long the bridegroom had tarried. They didn't either. They didn't know how long that was going to be. We're not told how long they were waiting, but long enough for them to fall asleep. And now all the oil in the lamps of the foolish virgins, it's all used up. And they trimmed the wick on their lamp, but they did not enough oil to make a light. And so they desired that those who brought extra would give to them. And in verse 9 it said, "But the wise answered, saying, Peradventure there will not be enough for us and you. Go ye rather to them to sell and buy for yourselves." Now that raises the question. It's at midnight. What store do you know of is open where you can go and just buy some coal oil or some kind of olive oil or something that will burn at midnight? Would that not cause you to be hard-pressed to find a place to find it? So the text tells us, we want you to give to us. Well, we don't have enough. You go to them that sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went away to buy, and evidently there was some place that could supply their need. But while they went away to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready, now here's the lesson, went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Now what do we learn about that? When the door was shut, there's not anybody to open it. It said, afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for you know not the day nor the hour. You know when that's going to be. Now, you lay this parable alongside the one of the faithful and the unfaithful servants, and you've got the parallel. You've got the need to be prepared at the time of the coming of the Lord. Now, that's the point that's being established. Now, this next parable is very similar to this in that it's talking about the parable of the talents. And, Jenny, do you have that information for me here? All right. Was I correct or did I miss it?
You are correct-ish. So
okay.
The talent is about 6,000 days' wages.
About 6,000. So it's twice what I had thought. Okay, 6,000 days' wages.
So if you assume that people work 6 days a week, that's about 20 years' wages.
Ooh-wee. That's a long time. Now that's one talent.
One talent.
Would be about 20 years' wages. Now, I want that to be in our thinking, because we read in this text about a man who only received one talent. And sometimes we pity this man because he only had one talent. And our understanding is a talent is the equivalent of some ability. And that's not necessarily true. It's not to suggest that this man only had one ability that he could perform well, and the rest he just made a mess out of. That's not the point. A talent was a measure of money. And when you consider the amount of a talent, the equivalent of 20 years' wages, the man who only had one talent, he had quite a lot, didn't he? He had quite a lot. Now, let's read it. It says, for it is as when. Now, what is as when? Again, we've got this parable that's used to illustrate a point. What is he illustrating that's like this? The coming of the Lord. The coming of the Lord is like this. That's the subject that he's been dealing with, even from the point of the faithful and unfaithful servant. He's talking about the coming of the Lord. The unfaithful servant, the wicked servant, wasn't prepared when the Lord came. He reasoned, he won't be today. He's going to tarry. And the foolish virgins, their reasoning was exactly the same. It won't be right now, and so we've got plenty of time. When the Lord comes, he said, no, you don't know when that's going to be. You need to watch. Now, again, for it is as when a man going into another country called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And to one he gave 5 talents. Now, 5 times 20, that'd be close to 100, wouldn't it? So that would be a lot of years. Jenny will tell us when. That's a lot of years. 5 talents. That's a lot of years' wages, okay? And here is another man that he only got 2. Well, now, if a talent is 20 years' wages, he got 40 years' wages. That's a lot of wages, isn't it? Okay? And then to another one. But a talent then being the equivalent of 20 years' wages, he got a lot of money too, didn't he? Well, now look at it. This next expression. To each according to his several ability. The man who's received 5 talents, he obviously had more than the 2-talent man and more than the 1-talent man. But each had the ability to manage what was given to them. Each one. Now, when we look at Christians, we say, well, we don't all do this, we don't all do that, and that we don't all have the same talent in that respect. I get it. But keep in mind, we're talking about a measure of money. But each one had the ability to manage what measure of money was given to him, even the 1-talent man. He had the ability to manage it. So they not all had the same ability, but they were given in accordance to their ability. And then the text goes on in verse 16, straightway, he that received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made other 5 talents. Let's not minimize that. If he had 5 talents, then he had about 100 years worth of wages. But he doubled it. Now he's got 200 years worth of wages. He got a lot of money, don't he? All right. And then in verse 17, in like manner, he also that received the 2 gained other 2. Now he's got a lot of money. He had 40 years wages. Now he's got 80 years wages. He's got a lot of money. It says, but he that received the one went away and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. And what did he do with it? He didn't do anything with it. He buried it. He buried it. Now his explanation is remarkable. We'll look at that in just a moment, but I want to note verse 19. It says, now after a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and maketh a reckoning with them. When the day that syllabus was passed out, you knew exactly how much time you had to do the work, right? But often students put it off to the last minute because they don't really expect the date on the calendar to ever get there. And it does. Inevitably it will. Now what we want to note here is that after a long time, the Lord of the servants came and he made a reckoning. You've got to answer. Well, now can you see why? Look at what he's given them. He's given them a lot when you consider the amount of wages that he has given them. There's a lot to answer for. And then in verse 20 it says, he that received the 5 talents came and brought the other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliveredest to me 5 talents. Lo, I've gained other 5 talents. And his Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will set thee over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Now, notice that first parable. We were talking about a faithful and an unfaithful servant. The term faithful is significant. He's been responsible with that which was placed into his trust. He's been responsible. And it tells us in verse 22, he also that received the 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliveredst unto me 2 talents. Lo, I've gained other 2 talents. And his Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will set thee over many. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Now the lesson on those two is the same. They both, according to their ability, they've doubled what was given to them. They've been commended and given greater responsibility. Now, verse 24. And he also that had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou didst not sow, and gathering where thou didst not scatter. Let's pause right there. This 1 talent man, he knows some things about his master. I know that you gather where you've not scattered. I know you're a hard man. So, I was afraid. And I went away and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, thou hast thine own. Now, can you see this 1 talent fellow breaking his arm, patting himself on the back, saying, look at how good I've done. I didn't lose it. I dug a hole and I buried it. Now, wait a minute. What he had was given in proportion to his ability. We've seen that. These others likewise were given in proportion to their ability. Their ability indicated that they had the wherewithal to use it to make more. And they've done very well. That's why they were praised, saying, good and faithful servant. But now we've got a man who was afraid. He didn't do anything with it. He dug a hole and offers as an excuse about what he knew about this man. Do you suppose these other servants didn't know the same thing he did? But in spite of what they knew about the master, they utilized their ability to use what the man had given them. This man did not. I was afraid and went away and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, thou hast thine own. But his Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant. Do you see him identified with the same term that's used up here concerning this servant in chapter 24? You wicked and slothful servant. Thou knewest that I reaped where I sowed not and gathered where I did not scatter. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the bankers, and at my coming I should have received back mine own with interest. Now that wouldn't have required a whole lot of him, would it? Just go put it in the bank. At least I could draw interest on what I gave you. Now, 1 talent being the equivalent of 20 years work. He should have seen a great return on that if he'd just put it in the bank. But he dug a hole and buried it. And he somehow expects his Lord to praise him for doing that. At least he didn't lose it. But now, the old motto that we have used for so many years, you either use it or you lose it. What happens to this man? He said, take ye away therefore the talent from him, and give it to him that hath the 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. And from him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away. And cast ye out the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There shall be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now you see how this comes full circle. The parable of the talents perhaps is the most familiar out of all three of these. But the parable of the talents goes right back to the very first one and complements what was said in the first parable. Because the wicked and slothful servant is the equivalent of the wicked servant in the 24th chapter. And he was cast out into the outer darkness. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Now what's the Lord illustrating? For it is when a man going into another. We're talking about the judgment, aren't we? We're talking about punishment, eternal punishment upon those who are not prepared. And we may reason, as we have on the board, the Lord may delay his coming. This is the common thread in all of these. But in all of these, the Lord did come, you see, and demanded a reckoning. Now, I've got a Bible here. There it is. I want to look at the text of Revelation 22 just briefly because it complements the text here. In Revelation 22, you'll note beginning in verse 14, the writer said, blessed are they that wash their robes, that they may have the right to come to the tree of life and may enter in by the gates into the city. Now without, he said, are the dogs and the sorcerers and the fornicators and murderers and idolaters and everyone that loveth and maketh a lie. Now what I want us to see very clearly is that the scene that Jesus is presenting in the latter part of Matthew 24 and on into chapter 25, he's discussing the judgment scene. And as John writes in Revelation 22, he describes those who are within and those who are without. And those who are within are blessed. Those who are without are cursed. Now that's the point that we want to remember from Matthew 24, the latter part of it, and Matthew 25, as he illustrates the need to be prepared, because that's the consistent thread that goes through these. In verse 42 of Matthew 24, watch therefore, for you know not on what day your Lord comes. Matthew 24:44, it's repeated, for in an hour that you think not, the Son of Man cometh. And then we see it in Matthew 25, verse 13. Watch, for you know not the day nor the hour. And you see the principle illustrated that after a long time, the Master came. But he came, and he demanded a reckoning. So the need to be prepared is emphasized throughout this. Now let's put this in its context. Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem, Matthew chapter 21. It was considered the day of triumph. We learn then in Matthew 22 that there's this controversy that has arisen between Jesus and the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Herodians. And we've looked at this long enough to know that Tuesday was a very long day. A long day of controversy. Because we've got this back and forth, back and forth. And then in chapter 23, Jesus pronounces 7 woes upon them. Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, and tells them why. And now he's expressed that you see these buildings at the temple, the day will come when one stone will not be left upon another. And it's going to come upon you. This generation, you'll see it. Such destruction, never before ever been seen, won't ever be seen again. But you're going to see it. And what do you need to do? You need to get ready. Because you don't know when that's coming. Now the lesson for us to take home is the Lord is coming. And we don't know when that's going to be either. And we see the transition, if you please, not so definitely started in this verse, but you see that it does take place. In these parables, you see obviously the transition that takes place. Now, yes?
I was going to say once again to point out that in chapter 24, verse 3, where this context starts was all the way through 26 and verse 5. And all of that is in response to the disciples asking the question, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?
Yeah.
I think he's gotten to the third thing that they asked.
Yeah.
They thought it was all the same.
Oh, they did? Yeah. But he's telling them about judgment.
Right. He's telling them about what's really going to happen rather than what they think is going to happen.
I believe that's so. Yeah. I believe that's so. So the lesson is you get ready. You be prepared. Here's the chart. I didn't remember which order I had it in. That there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Consistently used throughout the book of Matthew to talk about the final judgment. And Kyle Pope in his commentary on this says, this makes it clear that Jesus was not speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem, but the punishment of hell assigned to the wicked upon the final parousia or the final coming of the Lord at the day of judgment. I believe that's right. I'm just convinced that that's exactly right. We need to be prepared for that day. That's what is of great concern to us. Now, Matthew 25, beginning in verse 31, presents some detail of this judgment scene, the final judgment scene. And again, I want to perhaps just take a moment and read the text. You can't miss that. When you're reading the text, you know that's helpful. So let's look at it. Verse 31. But when the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and all the angels with Him, and then shall He sit on the throne of His glory, and before Him shall be gathered all the nations, and He shall separate them one from another. Do you see how the scene is expanded? We're not talking about Jerusalem. We're not talking about a specific locality as far as geographic locality is concerned. But we're talking about the Son of Man coming in His glory and sitting on His throne, and before Him shall be gathered everybody. All the nations shall be gathered, and He shall separate them one from another as the shepherd separated the sheep from the goats, and He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the King say unto them on His right hand. Again, notice the timeline. These expressions, then, and so forth. That's helpful. What's the then of this passage? In the final judgment. When He separated the sheep and the goats, He's going to tell them why. Did you know, and I'm sure that in this class you do, but did you know that there will not be a single solitary person, not a single solitary soul that goes to heaven that don't know why they're there? And there won't be a single solitary person that's in hell that don't know why they're there. This scene helps us with that. Because those on the right hand were told, come and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Now the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world, I don't believe He's talking about the church, I don't believe He's talking about the city of Jerusalem or the nation of Israel or something with geographic location. He's talking about the kingdom of heaven in heaven. That which Paul anticipated in 2 Timothy chapter 4 verse 18. He knew there was a place for him in the kingdom of heaven, the eternal kingdom. Now, Paul was already a member of the church, that is, the spiritual kingdom, as he had obeyed the gospel. But that's not what he anticipated in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 18. He anticipated entrance into the eternal kingdom. And the Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 5 through 11, talks about what we sometimes refer to as the Christian graces. And he said, if we add these things, we're diligent to do that, then there shall be richly supplied unto you entrance into the eternal kingdom. That's what Jesus is talking about here in this last illustration. Kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Well, how come? For I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry and fed thee, or athirst and gave you drink? Or when saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? And when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the King shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it unto one of these my brethren, even these least, you did it unto me. Now, a lot to be said on that, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, next week. But we want to know that these were granted entrance into the eternal kingdom on the premise they did what the Lord told them to do. They lived the right kind of life. Now in verse 41, Then shall he say also to them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into eternal fire, which is prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you did not give me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you took me not in. Naked, and you clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and you visited me not. Then shall they also answer, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry, or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not unto one of these least, ye did it not unto me. And these shall go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. I want to note that the application of all of this was on the premise of what they did or did not do. Now, somebody can argue and reason and say, well, you know, my life, I get to go to heaven because the Lord selected me to go to heaven. And you go to hell because you're not on the list. The Lord didn't put you on the list, so you spend eternity in it. No, that's not so. These were judged on the premise of what they did, not what God had done for them. These were judged on the premise of what they did, their obedience to the will of the Lord. And you'll note further, he said, depart from me, ye cursed, into eternal fire, which is prepared for the devil and his angels. Again, just a brief mention of this. We don't have the time to expand on it. But hell is not prepared for you. What is prepared for those who are righteous is the eternal kingdom. Come and inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Hell is not prepared for you. Hell's prepared for the devil and his angels. Now, you want to follow him? That's where you'll go. Now, that ought to get our attention. You want to follow him? That's where you'll go, don't it?
Clarification, then. You're starting chapter 25 of Matthew, verse 31. Is Wednesday?
No, I don't believe it is Wednesday. I believe we're still on the concluding things of Tuesday. Yes. We're not, I don't believe we're to Wednesday yet. No, I do not believe we are to Wednesday yet. More on that next week. I think that between Tuesday and Wednesday, there is some area of, I'll call it gray area. I'm not sure that there's a distinguishing line that I found in Scripture and say, well, because on tomorrow this happened, or the next day this happened. I don't think that we find that. Pardon me?
In Scripture, can you go back? I see here, Luke 21:37 in that next slide.
Well, I haven't gotten to the next slide yet. I'm not going to get to the next slide. But Luke 21:7 does, I'll go ahead and put the next slide up there. You want to look at the next slide? We'll look at the next slide. Every day he was teaching in the temple.
I just wanted to say that in the Scripture, you can go back to Luke 21:37.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's Wednesday.
Well, this happened every day.
Oh, this happened every day.
This happened every day. So, no, I don't think we can look up here and say, well, I was going to comment on that. Somebody said, well, what does he do on Wednesday? We know that every day he was teaching in the temple, and at night he went out and lodged in the mount called Olivet. So what did he do on Wednesday? He taught in the temple. What did he do on Tuesday? He taught in the temple. What did he do on Monday? He taught in the temple. The thing is, I don't have a laundry list of things that I can assign specifically to Wednesday like we can these other days. It may be possible that some of the events that we've had on the slides identifying Tuesday might have been on Wednesday. I'm just not sure of that, but I do know that most of the things that we've talked about that are assigned to Tuesday occurred on Tuesday. I don't have a laundry list that I can assign to Wednesday. Okay? We've got a number of things that we know occurred on Tuesday. But when we come to the next day, this is about all of God. He was in the temple teaching. This is what he did every day. Okay? Now, we're going to get to Thursday. And we're going to know that some events occurred on Thursday because of the timeliness of those events. The observance of the Passover and so forth was on that Thursday. And he was arrested when that Passover feast was through. And that was on Thursday. So we can identify some of those things with a little bit more definite identification. But the trail between Tuesday and Wednesday sometimes is a little bit blurred. Okay? Any other comment or question? That's a good question. And I'd like to make just a line, draw a line, say, well, it's right here. But I don't have the expression on the next day this happened. So I can't do that. Does that help? Okay. All right.